Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Why be a Thomist? That's the central question of this conference, our first ever Veritas conference. And my talk this morning will argue that being a Thomist not only helps your mind to know the truth, but that knowing this truth, above all, sacred truth, the truth about God, is a healing remedy for your mind that helps you to pray. Which is to say, it helps you to come to know God better as your Savior and your friend. It helps you to praise and thank Him better for all that He has done and is doing for you. And it helps you to be united to Him in love more and more profoundly. So we're going to take as our central text this morning a famous text from Aquinas, something that he often doesn't get enough credit for, which is being actually a great poet, a great medieval Latin poet, a theological poet. So we'll be taking a look at the Adorate Devote. It's a hymn that many of you probably know and probably have sung many times. For example, at adoration in the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. But what I hope to do is show you some of the hidden meaning of that beautiful text from Aquinas. But before we jump into the text itself, I want to start with some key ideas of St. Thomas about the Eucharist, because that will help us, it will set us up for understanding what he's saying in this poem. So this is going to be very brief, super quick summary. And if you want more, there's lots of good, great lectures on this on our podcast or on Aquinas 101, little advertisement there. The first point, the Eucharist is a sacrament. Okay, what does that mean? It means it's a sign that signifies and causes a spiritual reality. It's a sign that signifies and causes a spiritual reality as instituted by Jesus Christ himself. It comes about by divine power, but through what it signifies, through its signifying. It causes a spiritual reality precisely by signifying that reality. So in every sacrament, there is something there that is visible to us, or sensible to us, and also something deeper that that visible or sensible reality leads us into. It leads us into the true reality that is being communicated to us, a divine supernatural reality communicated to us through this sign. And that's the first and most fundamental point to grasp about Aquinas on the Eucharist and all the sacraments, to understand this sacramental way of thinking about how God leads us to himself. Now, in the Eucharist, let's think about the signs. The signs that we have before us are, above all, bread and wine. And, of course, the words of the priest at Mass, who quotes the words of Jesus at the Last Supper. He says, "This is my body. This is my blood." And in fact, we could also say in a certain way that the whole rite of the Mass is related to this signifying of the Eucharist. But it's especially this core set of signs, the bread, the wine, the words of consecration. So, when a validly ordained Catholic priest pronounces those words over bread and wine at the Mass, he is acting as an instrument of Jesus Christ himself. He is, as it were, lending his voice to Jesus He's a man sacramentally configured to Jesus, who is true God and true man, sacramentally configured to Jesus through the sacrament of holy orders. And then Jesus, who is true God and true man, by his divine power, working through the instrumentality of the ordained priest, changes the whole substance of the bread into the whole substance of the body of Christ, and he changes the whole substance of the wine into the whole substance of the blood of Christ. This is what the Catholic Church calls transubstantiation. And that's just a very complex technical term derived from the Latin, which means a change of the whole substance. Transubstantiation. However, there is something that doesn't change in this miraculous sacramental change. The accidents or the external appearances of the bread and wine are still there. Those things do not change. They are the one thing that passes over from one side of this equation, you might say, to the other. They are what perdures through this miraculous change. So, after the consecration, what is really there? The substance of Christ's body and blood. But the natural accidents of Christ's body and blood, like his height, his weight, his hair color, his eye color, these things are not present. Those are accidents or the external appearances of Christ's human body. Those things are not made directly present. What is directly present is his substance. Okay, so that's mysterious. Jesus is present in the Eucharist in the mode of substance, and the bread and wine are no longer there. But their accidents are there, which means their external appearances remain, while we know that what is really there under those accidents is a different substance, a substance that doesn't belong to those accidents, or those accidents don't belong to the substance now that is really there. And that's what is amazingly miraculous about the sacrament of the Eucharist. Jesus is really present in his substance, the substance of his body and of his blood, but his natural accidents are not present, while the natural accidents of bread and wine are still there, and under those appearances is the reality, the spiritual reality, of the substantial presence of Christ. Okay, you might be thinking, whoa, I feel like I'm in the deep end here. It's very mysterious how to think about this. Aquinas has some amazing things to say about how we come to know a substance, and that's what appears beautifully in his poetry, which helps our minds, which boggle before a mystery like this one, come to grips with it in a certain way and begin to marvel and even adore Christ's presence, which is brought to us through this sacrament. Okay, so let me try to explain a little bit of Aquinas' understanding of how we come to know a substance. Normally, when we encounter someone, St. Thomas would rightly emphasize that we encounter them in their external appearances. I meet Bennett, who just introduced me. I see his face, his eyes. I hear the words he speaks. I see the color of his hair, the height that he has. And I discover, by coming to know him a little bit, his thoughts, his emotions, his personality. If you only know Bennett from seeing him just a moment ago, you probably haven't gotten much deep insight into his person, have you? You've seen something about him. Maybe a police sketch artist could help you draw him if we had a manhunt on for him. But you wouldn't really know him. You wouldn't know who he really is. But by seeing him, especially over time, as we spend time in his presence, as we watch his face and his gestures, and we listen to the sound of his voice, we do progressively discover who is really there. We come to encounter the reality underneath those appearances. And that's a natural process. Do we perceive the substance of Bennett through the accidents of his physical appearance? Well, in a sense, yes. Because all of the properties of a person inhere in what that person is, in the being of that person. And we encounter the being of each person singularly in the experience of the accident features and characteristics of the person. Did you see the soul of Bennett when he was standing here? Well, you saw effects of his soul, certainly, because he was living and moving and speaking, and it seemed even rational, right? I think so. But we never directly perceive someone's soul in this life. We know that the soul is the principle, the form, that gives unity and life to the person. But we perceive the effects of that mediated through the material reality of the person. We perceive the substantial person before us through his actions and gestures and facial expressions and so on. Those are manifestations of what is really there. But they themselves are not just what is really there. There's something deeper, even in a human person, than just the external appearances. Now, notice that this is also the way, in a sense, that the divinity of Jesus was made manifest to the apostles and the other disciples in the New Testament through a gradual emergence in his words and gestures of his true identity. They began, probably, thinking that they were talking to a man. And, of course, they were. Jesus is truly a man. But he is not only a man. He also is truly God, the divine Son. But that was not immediately obvious to someone who happened to bump into Jesus in Galilee. It was through encountering his words and his gestures and the amazing things that he did, the profound wisdom that he was able to speak, the miracles that testified to the authority that he had from God the Father, that helped them gradually to grasp with their minds what was really there under these rather humble appearances, which is that this is the Father's Son. And the apostles moved, because of their faith, from the outward appearances, you might say, to understand the inner spiritual reality. That required a supernatural gift, a light to their minds, to be able to grasp who was really before them. Something like this also happens for us with the Eucharist. We move from the simple experience of a host, what looks like a little piece of bread, to a gradual awareness, and the more our minds are enlightened by faith and perfected by the gift of understanding, the more we come to, you might say, a mystical awareness of what is really there underneath that very simple appearance. And God willing, this spiritual awareness can grow and deepen through our lives. I hope it does for you. But notice that with the Eucharist, something different is happening. We're not beginning from an outward showing of ordinary human accidents, human characteristics like height and weight, hair color or eye color, or the sound of someone's voice. And we're also not inferring what is there from the experience of a person's words or gestures or speech acts. There's no ordinary experience of a human body in the Eucharist. What then is the basis for our knowledge that Christ is really present there? In the end, Aquinas thinks that it's simply that Jesus tells us that he is there. And since he is God in person, we believe him when he tells us this. And he has the power, because he is God, to make it so. When he speaks, what he says comes into being. Just as in the beginning, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. So growth in the knowledge of Christ's presence in the Eucharist does not come through our bodily senses. It's through a kind of spiritual perception, even an experience born of faith, an experience that is proper to the spiritual life. Aquinas calls this a certain kind of experience, and he ties it to the gift of understanding, where we're able to penetrate into, go deeper into the realities that we believe by faith. So this actually is very important for the spirituality of the Eucharist, and so now I'd like to actually turn to some of the text of Aquinas, and this is the last thing we're going to do before we look at the text of the Adorate itself. But on your handout, I've given you a quotation from Aquinas' Summa Theologiae. It's from the Secunda Secundae, the second part of the second part, question 8, article 1, on the gift of understanding. Now think about the Eucharist as we read this together, and I think you'll immediately get what I'm after. This text is basically saying, in more concise and scholastic form, what I've been trying to explain over the last few minutes. Here's what Aquinas writes. Understanding implies an intimate knowledge. For to understand, the Latin there is intellegere, is the same as intus legere in Latin, to read inwardly. This is clear to anyone who considers the difference between intellect and sense. I mean, by the way, intellect, what is he talking about there? Your understanding and your sense experience. There's a difference between your sense experience and what your mind grasps. Okay. Why? Because sensitive knowledge, he says, is concerned with external sensible qualities, whereas intellective knowledge penetrates into the very essence of a thing, because the object of the intellect is what a thing is, as Aristotle says in the De Anima. So anytime you come to know a natural reality, just a natural reality, Aquinas thinks, you are experiencing with your senses what is exterior, but your mind, because of the light of reason that it has, is able to penetrate into the reality that is before you and grasp what is really there, which is not just the external accidents and appearances, but the inner reality. Okay, let's go back to Aquinas' text. Now, there are many kinds of things that are hidden within, to find which human knowledge has to penetrate within, so to speak. Thus, under the accidents lies hidden the nature of the substantial reality. And now another example, under words lies their hidden meaning. Think about this for a moment. Like you're hearing sound vibrations that are coming from me, right? And they're striking your eardrum. And I'm speaking in English, and if you understand English, then you're grasping the meaning of the ideas I am trying to communicate to you. But this is mysterious. I could speak them in French, and if you spoke French, I hope, if I was speaking good French, you would also understand the meaning of what I am saying, but the words would be totally different. Because in speech, the idea that I have in my mind is being communicated through these sound vibrations to your mind so that not just sounds, but a truth would come also to exist in your mind. That's amazing, if you think about it. That's what our mind is capable of. By the way, computers don't do that. Just if anybody wants to talk about AI. We're talking about the Eucharist. Under likenesses and figures, the truth they denote lies hidden because the intelligible world is enclosed within, as compared with the sensible world, which is perceived externally. And effects lie hidden in their causes, and vice versa. We could say a lot more about that, but I think for reasons of time, I'll just keep moving. Hence, we may speak of understanding with regard to all these things. This is just on the natural level. Next paragraph. Since, however, human knowledge begins with the outside of things, as it were, it is evident that the stronger the light of the understanding, the light of the mind, the further can it penetrate into the heart of things. This is what your mind is capable of. Now, the natural light of our understanding is of finite power. Wherefore, it can reach to a certain fixed point. Consequently, man needs a supernatural light in order to penetrate further still, so as to know what it cannot know by its natural light. And this supernatural light, which is bestowed on man, is called the gift of understanding. The gift of understanding, a gift of the Holy Spirit, perfects faith, the virtue of faith, which is also supernaturally infused into us, so that we can go deeper into the mystery of God, the mystery of Christ, all the things that we believe in the faith. Okay, so with this preface now, let's turn finally to Aquinas' theological poetry. And before we actually look at the words itself, let me tell you a little bit about the historical background. Because I was amazed to discover earlier this year, as I was working on the Adoro Te Devote, some really interesting, fascinating things about this text. Now, you may know that Aquinas is credited, I think, rightly. There's a little bit of historical, you know, scholarly question about this, but I think it's fairly well established. He's the author, or at least the principal author, of the Liturgy of Corpus Christi, the Feast of the Body and Blood of Christ, which was instituted by Pope Urban IV in Aquinas' lifetime, and the Pope asked Aquinas to write the liturgical texts for this feast. So that's the text for Mass, and also the text for the Divine Office, including hymns. So Aquinas wrote a series of hymns, as well as a lesson, basically a reading for the Office of Readings, and the antiphons, and the other things that would be chanted at the Mass. He prepared all of that. Some of that he was drawing from other sources, so that's why scholars sometimes have a debate about exactly what came from Aquinas, but it seems pretty clear that the hymns that he wrote were really written by him, and they're rich, beautiful theological hymns. Okay, Adoro Te Devote, that's part of the Corpus Christi liturgy, right? Wrong. No, actually, I had always thought that, but when you begin to study it, it turns out it was not written as part of the Corpus Christi liturgy. Well, what is it? In fact, it's probably not a hymn at all. Why do we say that? Because no medieval hymn speaks in the first person. And that's what the hymn begins with. Adoro te devoli. I adore. It would be unusual and basically liturgically unheard of to have a hymn speaking in the first person. Now, in some contemporary Catholic worship, there are hymns that speak in the first person, but the classic medieval hymns generally don't do that. It wasn't set to music in the oldest manuscripts. In fact, it's divided. I'll explain some of the divisions about it in a minute. It refers in the first stanza to both species of the Eucharist. body and blood, as if the person saying these words is in the presence of both species, body and blood. That's really interesting. And then it's even more helpful to learn that in the Middle Ages, there was a long tradition of what are called elevation prayers. These are said by somebody, not the priest, but somebody who's at Mass at the time when the priest elevates the chalice and elevates the host. Now, remember that Mass in the Middle Ages, and what is still the case in the extraordinary form of the Roman Rite and the Dominican Rite, the Eucharistic prayer, that is the Roman canon, was said by the priest in a whispered voice. So if you were attending Mass, there would normally be a long period of silence before and after the consecration. And it would be punctuated by bells and then the elevation of the Eucharistic species, which in the Middle Ages was considered really the most important thing that you could do when you went to Mass, was to see the host, pray devoutly at that moment. Not everyone received Holy Communion every time they went to Mass, but it was really important that you be there to pray before the sacrament as it was elevated. And this would be a time of silent personal prayer when you're trying to unite yourself to the sacrifice of Christ being made present again by the priest standing at the altar. So you wouldn't be listening to the priest speaking the words of the Eucharistic prayer aloud, but you would be trying to focus your mind on what the priest is doing spiritually. And so some people came to memorize prayers that they would say silently in their own minds at that moment of the Mass. Now, we know that Aquinas had a great Eucharistic piety. He celebrated Mass every morning as long as he wasn't sick, according to the historical records, which was notable in his time. He would get up very early in the morning, and he would celebrate Mass in one of the side chapels at the Dominican church where he lived in various places in the period when he probably wrote this hymn or this prayer. He was living in Orvieto. Orvieto is the city where the papal curia was residing. It's just north of Rome. It's also the great center of Eucharistic devotion. It was where the miracles that brought to the universal church the Feast of Corpus Christi took place. So if you go to Orvieto today, you can still go and see, like they have a corporal, the cloth on which the priest celebrates Mass, where a host began to bleed during the Mass and blood stained the corporal, things like that. Okay, so medieval Orvieto is the place where everyone understands the profound mystery of the Eucharist. Aquinas was living there probably for about 4 or 5 years, and it was there that, it seems, he wrote this prayer in poetic form. So Aquinas celebrated Mass every day. He had his socius, his secretary, his name is Reginald. We have a brother Reginald here standing in that long tradition. Brother Reginald was his socius and his secretary who would serve Aquinas' Mass. When Aquinas finished, then Brother Reginald, who was also a priest, would celebrate his Mass and Aquinas would serve. Now think about this. Aquinas was one of the greatest theologians and a very famous man in his own time. He would be kneeling in the dark of a Dominican church early in the morning at the foot of the altar while his companion and friend celebrated the Eucharistic prayer. And I think the most likely explanation of the Adorate Devotee is that this is the prayer that Aquinas composed for his own use to recite when Brother Reginald would elevate the host and the chalice. So it gives you not only an insight into his theology of the Eucharist, but also into the spirit of the man. And that's why I love this prayer. Okay, so let's look at its text. Now, traditionally, in modern editions, it's divided into four-line stanzas. But in fact, in the manuscript, the oldest manuscripts, it's not divided that way, which is just interesting. You could probably divide it into two-line couplets, because if you look at it, the last word every two lines is rhyming. Each line has 11 syllables, except, curiously, the first line, which has 12, which has caused some people to speculate that maybe this is not actually the original first line and somehow the text got corrupted. But the best manuscript evidence we have is that this is the first line. The first line usually reads Adorate Devote Latens Deitas, but the oldest manuscripts say Latens Veritas. Interesting. What does that mean? Adorote, so I've given you my literal translation. It's not very poetical, but it's trying to be theological in the center column here. And then on the right, you have the famous poetical translation of Gerard Manley Hopkins, which is a beautiful hymn. But, you know, I wanted you to see both because I think putting them both together gives you a better result. Okay, Adorote Devote Latens Veritas. Devoutly I adore you, truth in hiding. Think about what we were just talking about the reality hiding beneath the appearances. That's what Aquinas is talking about. So what is the truth there? Well, that's an interesting question. It's the truth of the body of Christ. It's the truth who is Jesus himself. It means both, I think. Te quae sub eis formis vere latitas. You who under these forms, plural, the form of bread, the form of wine, are truly hidden. Tibi se cor meum totum subicit, quia te contemplans totum deficit. To you my heart completely subjects itself, because contemplating you all else fails. You could translate that line in several ways, but I think this is the better translation. Nothing else compares to the reality that I am contemplating when I am looking at the Eucharist. Now, next stanza. Visus, tactus, gustus, in te fallitur. Sight, touch, taste, fail with respect to you. The idea here is you are really there, Jesus. But my sight doesn't tell me that, nor does my touch, nor does my taste. Sed auditu solo tute creditur. Hearing alone is safely believed. Think of St. Paul. Faith comes by hearing. Credo quidquid dixit Dei Filius, nihil veritatis, verbo verius. This is an awesome line. I believe whatever the Son of God says. What does he say? This is my body. This is my blood. I believe him when he says it. Why? Because, last line in the stanza, nothing is more true than the word of truth. But the Latin there is actually really beautiful and multivalent. Nihil veritatis verbo verius. Nothing is more true, nihil verius, than veritatis verbo, the word of truth. Okay, what is the word of truth? Well, it's the words spoken by Jesus who is the truth. It's the word there who is truth, who is truly God and man. There's a richness to the Latin poetry. Let's look at the next page. In cruce latebat sola deitas. On the cross, only divinity was hidden. Think about that. The apostles, the disciples, they had come to know that Jesus was truly the Son of God. But very many of the people who encountered Jesus did not believe that. They thought he was just a man who was, on their view, committing blasphemy because he was claiming a divine authority. And that's why they crucified him. On the cross, what was visible? A man who appeared to be weak and wounded and dying. as the prophet Isaiah tells us, his form was so disfigured we could hardly recognize him. There was no beauty to be seen there. On the cross, his divinity was hidden, but his humanity was clearly on view. But here, next line, but here, at the same time, simul et humanitas latet. Humanity hides at the same time. In the person of Jesus, in his natural appearance during his earthly ministry, his divinity is hidden underneath the appearances of his humanity. But in the Eucharist, both his humanity and his divinity are hidden beneath the appearances of bread and wine. But then Aquinas adds, ambo vere credens atque confitens, truly believing and even confessing both, peto quod petivit latro penitens. I ask, I petition for what the repentant thief asked for. What did that thief ask for? Listen to the Gospel of Luke. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other rebuked him, saying, do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. And he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. Aquinas identifies himself with the repentant thief. What does that tell you about the spirit of this man? Famous theologian, son of a high aristocrat, headed towards recognition around the world for his erudition, he calls himself a repentant thief. Who was the patron saint of St. Thomas Aquinas? Well, Thomas the Apostle. He appears in the next stanza. Plagas, sicut Thomas, non intueor. Your wounds I do not see, as Thomas did. Deum tamen meum te confitior. But nonetheless, I confess you to be my God. What is that referring to? When Jesus rose from the dead, he appeared to the disciples, but Thomas was not present on that first Easter evening. And when he learned from the others that Jesus had been there, he said, I will not believe unless I see the wounds and put my finger into the nail marks and my hand into his side. So 1 week later, when Jesus appears, Thomas is present. And what does Jesus do? He says, Thomas, put your finger into my wounds and your hand into my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believe. What does Thomas say in response? He says, my Lord and my God. Thomas Aquinas, following the Church Fathers, observes about this passage that the Apostle Thomas saw one thing and confessed something else. What did he see? The body of the resurrected man. He saw a man who had been dead, who is now alive. You could respond to that and say, Jesus, you were dead, and now you are alive. But that is not what Thomas says. He confesses what he did not see, what his finger could not touch, which is that this man is God. That requires an act of faith. It is not something that the senses perceive. So Aquinas says, I do not see your wounds as Thomas did, but I confess you to be my God. Fac me tibi semper magis credere, inte spem abere te diligere. Make me always to believe in you more, to hope in you, to love you. The theological virtues. This also is one of Aquinas' core teachings. Living out the theological virtues is the way that you live out the Christian life. And if you are growing in faith and hope and charity, you are growing in your spiritual life. That's probably the best measure of your spiritual health. We don't have time to dally. Let's move to the next line. O memoriale mortis Domini, O memorial of the death of the Lord. The sacrament of the Eucharist is a commemoration of his death. Jesus does not die again when the Mass is celebrated, but the Eucharist is the sacrament of his passion, which brings it to our minds and allows us in a certain way to encounter it. Not as if it is happening again, but as it is being applied to us. So Aquinas holds that the Eucharist has its effect on us, and its effect is the effect of the passion of Christ. It's being applied to me individually, here, today, this morning, as I adore, as I receive the Eucharist. Panis vivus, vitam, praestans omini, living bread, granting life to man. This is the proper effect of the Eucharist, according to Aquinas, to give spiritual life. Grant to me always to live from you, de te vivere, and always to savor your sweetness. Aquinas here is evoking the whole tradition of the wisdom literature of the Bible, where we savor the sweetness of the Lord, the sweetness of his wisdom. But in the Eucharist now, that bread of wisdom has become bread that we eat. It's spiritual bread, which gives life to our souls. The next stanza, Pie pelicane, Jesu Domine, me immundum, munda tuo sanguine. Okay, this is a medieval image of Jesus crucified, understood as a pelican. Sometimes you will see this on the front of an altar. It's an old tradition to depict a pelican, and a pelican with its young around it, with its beak pointed at its breast. Why? Because the medievals had this idea that the pelican would feed its young by pecking its own breast and causing the blood to come out and feeding its young with blood. That's because apparently when you ruffle the feathers of a pelican at its breast, they have a reddish tinge. So somehow this idea came into being that people thought that the pelican was wounding itself to feed its young. That's actually not what the pelican is doing. It's just ruffling its feathers, which are red. But let's not let that, you know, disturb our piety here. Why is this an image of Christ in the Eucharist? Well, you can infer what's happening. Jesus is being wounded so that his blood will come out and give us life. And Aquinas says, cleanse my unclean self by your blood, one drop of which would be sufficient to save the whole world from every sin, something that Aquinas says many times. And I see that Dr. Jonathan Lunin is here, astrophysicist or astronomer, and we co-taught a class about whether there's life on other worlds. This is one of Dr. Lunin's specialties. You can talk to him later today if you'd like to know more about that. Aquinas says, interestingly, the blood of Christ is sufficient to cleanse our in whole world of sin, and in fact, an infinite number of worlds if there were such. So the idea of other worlds is not so wild. Aquinas was already thinking about it in the Middle Ages. But let's look now at the last stanza.
Jesus.
Quem velatum nunc aspicio, whom veiled I now look on. What's he referring to? Veiled. He's veiled under the appearances of bread and wine. When will what I so thirst for be accomplished? Quando fiat? When will it be done? Illud quod tam sicio, that which I so thirst for. Think about the man Aquinas kneeling before the Eucharist and saying this. What is he thirsting for? He's thirsting for God. He's thirsting to see God. Of course, Jesus on the cross also says, I thirst. And what's the very next thing that Jesus says in John's gospel? It is accomplished. Aquinas echoes the words of Jesus on the cross. When will what I thirst for be accomplished? So that, beholding you with unveiled face, think St. Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, we are awaiting this unveiled face. As the glory of the Lord changes us into his likeness, this is what Aquinas is longing for. So that beholding you with unveiled face, I would be blessed by the sight of your glory. That is our eternal destiny, to see God face to face. And when we see him that way, we will be endowed with his glory. This is what is happening in the Eucharist. That glory is veiled, but really present. When we adore him with faith, that glory begins to illumine our souls. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.